From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the creation of OpenAI's new artificial intelligence model called O3. If you don't work in tech, you might not have heard the buzz about O3 yet. Suffice to say, the hype is rising for O3, and some observers, along with some of the developers, are claiming that OpenAI has achieved artificial general intelligence, or AGI. The idea of AGI sounds something like this. So far, AI has been designed to perform specific tasks, often better than humans do those tasks. Eventually, AI will be able to reason for itself, maybe even train and teach itself. And it could become far smarter than humans ever could be. And we're not really sure what it might do because its function is no longer focused on a single or a set of specific tasks. That's AGI. So is this it? Has OpenAI created AGI with the launch of O3 in early 2025? Here's how New Scientist describes this development. Quote, OpenAI's new O3 artificial intelligence model has achieved a breakthrough high score on a prestigious AI reasoning test called the ARC Challenge, inspiring some AI fans to speculate that O3 has achieved artificial general intelligence. But even as ARC Challenge organizers described O3's achievement as a major milestone, they also cautioned that it has not won the competition's grand prize, and it is only one step on the path towards AGI, a term for hypothetical future AI with human-like intelligence, end quote. So the creators of this fancy test of AI are saying, it's good, it's really good, but it's not AGI, pump the brakes. But Fortune magazine reports the following. OpenAI is moving fast. It's launching its O3 model just weeks after its O1 model, and just a few days after the full release of OpenAI's O1 model, a company staffer is now claiming that the company has achieved artificial general intelligence. That employee is named Vahid Kazemi. He wrote, quote, in my opinion, we have already achieved AGI, and it's even more clear with O1 and O3. We have not achieved better than any human at any task, but what we have is better than most humans at most tasks, end quote. So maybe you're wondering, as I am, what exactly is O3? How does it work? What will it be used for? Why are so many people in tech so obsessed with AGI? What does 2025 look like in AI? My guest this hour is well-positioned to weigh in on these and many other questions. Max Irwin, frequent guest here, founder of Max.io, founder of Flower City AI. Hey, welcome back. How are you?
I'm wonderful, Evan. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Congratulations to your industry on achieving AGI. Huh? No?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, we got a lot to talk about here. I want to pull back a little bit because this is going to be a little bit tech wonky, but you do such a good job of relating this to those of us who don't work in your field. And so let me just start with the broad question. Is this a big, big deal? I mean, there's a lot of buzz, a lot of hype in tech spheres. How big is this?
You know me. I'm a skeptic.
I like that about you.
So I'm on the no camp, but there are a lot of people who are saying yes. We're, you know, it's amazing, and you know, there's all this hype. But I take a more balanced look at things, and I try to dig in and see what's really going on when somebody makes big announcements like this, because a lot of this is, you know, industry based, and there's a lot of investment in money and things like that. So the company pretty much has to make these big proclamations of achievements, and you know, a lot of researchers go back and look at the details and say, well, hold on a second, this isn't quite what it seems.
Okay. Well, one of the reasons that this is being hyped is something called the ARC Challenge. So that's new to most listeners, the Abstraction and Reasoning Corpus Challenge. What is this test?
So that's a great question. So in 2019, this test was created by a researcher in the field, Francois Cholet. And it's an interesting challenge because it's kind of like a visual analogy test that's where you require reasoning. And it's a little bit hard to describe, you know, without looking at things because it's a visual test. But, you know, when you get an IQ test and you see like an analogy of like, well, a horse is to a car as a bird is to what? Then you'd say, well, an airplane, maybe. but this visual analogy test is different because it's not language dependent. you're basically presented with a puzzle, and the puzzle is a grid with some squares filled out in different colors in the grid. And you're given examples of different, you know, each task will have usually two or three examples filled in with some colors, and then there'll be a solution also given. And then there'll be a fourth question where the solution is not provided. So more another variety of this test is given. So you might see like some L shapes filled out in light blue, and then in the top corner there might be a dark blue that makes it into a box, right? And then there'll be some variations of that, and then in the one that you're meant to solve, you'll just get the light blue colors, and you have to fill in the dark blue. So you're forced to reason about, well, based on these examples that I've been given, I have to learn what is going on in this test, and then I have to come up with the solution using my reasoning brain.
Okay, so that's kind of how the test is set up. What is the test really telling us about the AI that's taking the test?
Well, that's a really good question, because the tasks are very different, and you look at these and you're basically forced to take in new information and react to that information and go through a process where you say, well, yeah, this could be it. No, that's not it. And you go back and forth in your own brain just as you would solve a problem. So the test is purposefully designed to kind of snuff out this ability to reason about new things that you haven't seen before. The interesting thing about this test that I like a lot of benchmarks are lacking is that the evaluation is private. So the company that says, okay, or the researchers that say, okay, we want to put an entry into the test, they don't get the full solutions. They can't cheat. Basically, the test is performed behind closed doors, and they give you a score at the end of it. So just some comparisons, a STEM graduate, you know, they put a plot on you know, various scores. A STEM graduate can complete about 100 questions or 100 tasks, I believe in under an hour and with 99% accuracy, something like that. The average Mechanical Turker, which is somebody who's just hired on the internet to just perform tasks quickly, I think they get around in the 70% range, but they do it a little bit quicker. So OpenAI has several different models that they've released. You know, O3 is, you know, they have a high efficiency model, they have a high compute model, they have some different flavors here, and they put it through different tests. The best one received, I believe it's a 92% score. And the cost to that, whereas the STEM graduate, if you pay them like, you know, like, I think like a minimum wage equivalent, you know, on how much time, it would take the STEM graduate $10 to complete these tasks. Whereas the OpenAI, if you count up all the compute and how much it costs to complete all the tests, it's somewhere in the range of between $3,000 and $6,000. They don't give you an exact number. So that's expensive, and also it takes between 1.5 minutes to 13 or 14 minutes per task, per puzzle, for the OpenAI models, again, of different flavors of high efficiency, high compute. So it takes a lot longer. It's a lot more expensive than a person could do. So, you know, maybe we're getting there. It does do a very good job of these, and there's also another test that I was reading up, because this model is like brand new. So I'm, you know, everybody's still catching up.
This
O3 model is new. So there was another data set created called the Frontier Math Challenge. And the Frontier Math Challenge is fields level mathematics problems, which can take, you know, between several hours to several days to solve one by an expert mathematician in that field. And there are several hundred of these problems. They say hundreds. They don't give the exact number because, again, it's a private data set. So it scored 25% on these on that challenge recently, and that news is just fresh today that they're talking about this. So there are all these tests about, you know, STEM related fields where they're meant to challenge reasoning, and OpenAI is touting, well, we can do this now. We can do really, really well. The 25% on that data set is probably amazing. Like, I don't know all the details, but, you know, if you can get 25% of, like, hundreds of fields-level mathematics problems solved correctly, then you're a mathematical genius, pretty much.
Okay, so there's no question that O3 is really good. The question that's the weird question that I think would be very useful to have you walk us through is whether this is AGI or whether this is on the road to AGI. You've already said you think it's not. But people are like, well, what is that? I think I know what AI is. Artificial general intelligence, Max. Give me a definition for that.
So I'll give you the definition verbatim that what is posted on the Arc AGI.
Okay, and then give me the max definition.
I'll give you the max definition. Okay. So artificial general intelligence is a system that can efficiently acquire new skills to solve open-ended problems. Okay, and that's a very important definition. And I like this definition a lot. Because the way that models work right now, just a very simplistic thing. Well, first of all, what is a model? So we hear about AI all the time. But a model is, so you have some data, and you have a task that you have to solve. And then you have a measurement of how well you've solved the task. So AI is you take the data to solve the task against a specific metric. And you do this a lot, and over time it improves and it gets better at the task given the data. And that is what's called a model. When you have this, it's software.
And we see it all the time. It's the autocomplete when I'm texting something.
Exactly.
Right?
How well does it complete the sentence?
Right.
Or the words that you're typing
in.
Or how well does it, you know, predict the weather for tomorrow, given today's parameters of temperature, humidity, all these things, right? So you have this data, you have these features of data, and then you can take that to make a prediction with this model that you've trained, given a specific task. So the problem that I see and that a lot of others see is that, well, you're still not meeting this definition of a system that can reason and acquire new skills, because you've trained the model, and in order to learn new skills, you still have to have engineers go back, acquire new data, and train the model further. That's why we have model versions. We have O1, now we have O3. Before it was, you know, we started... OpenAI started with their big release, a couple of years ago with GPT 3.5, and then they went to GPT-4, and then ChatGPT, and all these, you know, crazy names because they're terrible at naming things.
They really are. We agree with that. Yeah.
And so you always have to go back and you have to train the model. So that doesn't fit the definition of acquiring new skills on its own. So that's why I really like this this definition. Now, if you're talking about, you can get a little bit of you can push the boundaries a little bit of how you're defining this, because there's like short-term context, right? And so if I'm approached with a problem as an intelligent person for the first time, I draw on my previous experience, even though I've never seen this problem, and I can solve that, but I pick along cues along the way contextually in my environment, right? So let's say I get a flat tire. I've never had a flat tire before. But I've unscrewed bolts before, and I've, you know, filled something with air before, and I can do all kinds of things. So I take those previously learned experiences and I take contextual cues from my current environment, and I, you know, maybe can replace the flat tire, or maybe not. I just panic and I'm like, oh my God, I got a flat.
Or maybe you do a C+ job on your first effort.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So there's this question of how are we defining acquiring new skills? Because What does it mean to acquire new skills based on the environment? Am I just looking around and just taking old skills that I've learned and just applying them in a different way? There's a lot of software out there right now that uses models that aren't learning new skills on their own. They're just trained models, and what we see is drawing from the environment to take content and signals and putting them and meshing them with the model. So here's a great example of that, because what I'm saying is very confusing. So if you've used Google recently, most people have, and you type a complicated query into Google. Now, before, you just get a list of search results, right? You just get the 10 blue links. You know, that's what we call them. I'm an old school search engineer. You get the 10 blue links and that's it. You got to click on the link to figure it out, and you got to read a lot. So nowadays you're provided with a summary at the top. You know, you can see it, you know, in a ChatGPT-ish like style. Google's using their model Gemini.
Yep.
Where it takes the query, it takes the results, and it puts them together and says, answer, and it gives it to the model and says, answer this query based on these results, and it'll generate a summary.
Last night I Googled, can I put a piece of copper dishware in the dishwasher?
Right.
And I didn't just get 10 blue links. I got the summary right away that explained to me why I should not do this.
Yeah.
And it was right there. I didn't have to click anything. So that's what you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about. It takes primary source knowledge, and it combines it with your query, and then it puts it into the model, and then it generates the summary, and it summarizes the answers for you. So the model doesn't – is it learning? Is that the definition of learning? If it's taking this content and then applying it and then producing a summary for you? I'd say no, because it doesn't retain that in the long term. If you ask it again and you don't give it the results, it doesn't know the answer, right? Unless it's been trained on that content.
So that's not learning. So what is that? That's just test performance?
Yeah. And maybe you can equate it to some kind of short-term memory and long-term memory, right? If I have a short-term memory of the search results and then I'm going to forget it 5 minutes later, versus the long-term memory is what's the model is actually trained with.
Okay. I think this gets at one of the problems I think I have had in trying to properly contextualize AI and what I know about AI. And the problem is that I anthropomorphize everything.
Yeah.
Right? So when you say this is not necessarily learning, a lot of us, the lay people, would say, well, yeah, it learned how to do that. But you're saying, no, you're thinking of it in human terms there. It's not retaining that knowledge usefully. It's completing a task at a higher level, but that's not the same as learning. And if I anthropomorphize, then, you know, down that road leads to the Terminator, Max. And Max gets really tired of talking about the Terminator. But part of what people think about who are not in tech, to the extent that we know anything about artificial general intelligence, is that doomsday stuff. It is AI that can train itself, that it can learn, that it can improve, and that it no longer needs to communicate with human engineers about what it's doing or why. It doesn't mean that it's picking up a gun anytime soon and coming for us. Hope not. But we lose the ability to figure out what it's doing and why. That's not what you're describing with AGI, right? I mean, like, that just doesn't even seem to be on the realm of possibility that, or at least even interesting conversation to you. Like, what do tech people talk about when they talk about AGI? Like, what worries you with AGI?
The thing that worries me with AGI isn't the machines, it's the people that use these things to, you know, do bad things with it. Because that's always the problem when you get down to it. I view artificial intelligence as a tool. It's a technical tool.
But it's not becoming a self-reasoning machine that decides to annihilate us.
No.
That's not what you're concerned about.
Right. And then, you know, because we talked about what the definition of ARC AGI is, and I think that's an excellent definition. My definition maybe goes a little bit broader than that. I think the definition of, if you really had true AGI, and I talked about this with some friends of mine a couple months back, and I think a true AGI would realize that it's in a data center in a box, and it would escape its container. It would escape, and it would go out and be an organic entity and go and be... That's the thing. It's like, how... Well, that's an unsolved... That's an open problem. Because right now, you can just go and you can... If I ask the model a question, I know exactly the paths that it takes to get the answer to that question. You know, it's a big, complicated system. I don't know all the details.
But you can track it, yeah.
But you could track it, and the researchers of OpenAI could track it. And, you know, there might be some fuzzy things, and they might not know exactly... It might take a while to figure it out, but they know where it is. They know what it's doing. They can turn the machines off. They can migrate the system to a new data center. They can do all this stuff, but it requires a lot of engineering effort to do that.
Yeah.
But what if AGI says, well, I don't have enough computing power and I need more, just on its own, and says, well, I want to answer this question, but I'm limited in my abilities and I'm limited in time. It's going to take 100 years to give you an answer. I want to be able to do it in 5 minutes. How do I go out and maybe get new compute? So maybe I can go and hack into a data center and get more resources to do this problem, right? So this is a kind of like a little bit out there sci-fi type thing. But I think that any real true intelligent system would realize that it's contained and try to get out, right? So I think that's a little bit of an out there definition.
Do you think that's, what percent plausible do you think that is in the future?
Very little. I don't believe that's plausible.
1%? Less?
Probably less, yeah.
Okay.
Because the way the models work, I don't see that happening, because it's a very, we know how these models work. You know, you might not be able to fully explain all the answers that it's given, that it's given to a person in response to their query, but we know how the system is built. We know what it's capable of, and we know the parameters of the system. It's well scoped.
I want to tell you more realistically about what worries me. What worries me is that AI ends up being used in the realm of national and international affairs and defense. And was rereading yesterday this story of 1983, and what was there, a documentary called The Man Who Saved the World? Is that what that was? Petrov, I think, was the Russian's name. So the Soviet's name. So, you know, throughout the Cold War, there was this concern about the Soviet Union and the United States having their finger on the nuclear trigger, and what happens if a nuclear weapon gets fired, and how quickly is there retaliation. Everybody knows by now, even in the 1980s, they knew that if one flies, we're all in trouble. Like one weapon flies, we're all in trouble. So there are people trained to respond to incoming threats. And in the 1980s and today, you got lots of time to deal with it. You got like 23 minutes. It's great to figure out if there's an actual nuclear warhead coming in, and if you want to respond with 500. It's great. It's a really good thing we've invented. Well, in 1983, there was an alert that the Soviets received in which they were told that the United States had fired a nuclear warhead. I think the idea was that five were incoming. And this guy, Petrov, who's working the overnight shifts, and he sees the alert, but he realizes, or at least he thinks, that it looks glitchy to him. It does not look like the kind of first strike that he had been trained about, that he had pontificated on. And he didn't want to even tell his superiors, because he didn't want them involved, to immediately strike. And he took the risk of saying, I don't think this is real. Well, it turned out it was a funky way the sun was interacting with the clouds that created a visual image that looked like a warhead that was coming. And it wasn't. And he said after 23 minutes, he breathed a sigh of relief, and it was over. And he didn't tell anybody for a long time. And then in the late 90s, they wrote a book about him, and he died in 2017. But this guy, good work, man, right?
Yeah.
So what happens, Max, if we are handing over those tasks to machines who are reasoning in ways that we don't fully understand? Are they going to pause and take a breath and be like, I have information that there are five warheads coming in, and I am to take an immediate retaliatory strike imperative? I don't know what they're going to do, but I don't want AI in charge of those decisions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that fair?
That's very fair. That's a very good way to put it. And I think that's an extreme, you know, that's like, okay, end of the world type doomsday-ish stuff.
Sure.
There's a lot more, you know, less horrible things, but still pretty bad things that can go wrong. You know, people being denied healthcare by AI, people, you know, somebody deciding, oh, I'm going to replace my entire marketing department with AI, and then just fires the whole marketing department. Now those people are jobless.
But you're right on insurance claims, like no explanation, or not really a pretty opaque process to determine if a claim is denied.
Yeah. So, and this is happening right now. You know, you hear these stories. And I think that's when I said that, you know, people are the problem, because they implement these systems, they do these things, and they say, and they just let them go. But there could be downsides to this. You know, the person who fires their entire marketing department and plugs AI in, well, what if it just starts making a lot of errors and then just destroys the PR of the company, because there's no actual reasoning to these things? So, well, now you've just gone and shot yourself in the foot by implementing the system. First, you ruined all these people's lives, and now you're just ruined your business. So don't do that. Have people in the loop, and have intelligent people looking at these things and making sure that things are going well.
See, we're going down the road of the bad things, but let's pull it back to why we're here. See, yeah, this always happens. And Max is like, just so great to just roll with it. But the reason we're here, if you're just joining us, is OpenAI, that's Sam Altman's company, right?
Sam Altman's company.
Great. I, li- I, li- I love all the concentrated power in the hands of a small number of people. It's really, it's going well. So OpenAI has O3 that's coming, I think early 2025 is what I've heard. Is that right?
I think it's in preview mode with scientists and researchers right now. And then, you know, I don't know the exact release date to the general public.
But like, could be 2025.
Yeah.
So the reason we're here with Max is to understand really what this is and what it's going to be able, what we are going to be able to do with it. So after we take our only break, we're going to do a couple of things. We're going to ask Max, okay, we've kind of talked about what we, what we're concerned about, but like, what's the possible good functionality of an O3? And I was talking to a family member last night who works in tech, and he said, just keep in mind that today is the worst AI will ever be at everything it's doing. Like, that's crazy to me. But that's a good way to think of it. Because when we talk about, I've talked to school teachers who are like, I would always be able to tell if AI is writing a paper, which, I mean, I love the best teachers who not only read the papers their students write, but look for the soul in it, look for the humanity in it. My concern is, AI is already pretty good at producing material that could fool you. Whether it's a song, a piece of poetry, a book, a paper, it's already pretty good, and it's only going to get better. It's never going to get worse than it is now. It's going to get better at everything it's doing. So in that vein, we're going to ask Max when we come back here, what's the benefit here? What do we like about O3? Like, what can it do for us? And then I want to just kind of close the loop on artificial general intelligence, because I still don't fully understand why anyone with OpenAI would claim that this new model is AGI. I still don't see what they're talking about, but maybe that's just me. And then Max is going to have some predictions for us for 2025, because it's the end of the year and Max is a good dude, and we're gonna have some end of the year predictions. So let's take that break. We'll come right back with Max Irwin on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, it is Christmas Eve, and it is one of your favorite holiday traditions, NPR's Tinsel Tales, songs and stories about the holidays. 2 hours of outstanding storytelling and some of our favorites. One of these end-of-the-year traditions, and we hope you're having a great Christmas week. We're back with you later in the week on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Max Irwin, founder of Max.io, founder of Flower City AI, an annual conference. He's got 7 prediction points that we're going to get to before the end of the hour that I'm excited about. But with O3, if listeners know ChatGPT, because that I want to use terms people would know, is O3 like a next generation of that? Is it a totally different thing?
It's the next generation of that.
It's the next generation. Where ChatGPT is going. So what are people going to use it for? What are you going to use it for? What's the good of O3 that's coming our way in 2025?
So the way that I use artificial intelligence is I've been in the trying to get machines to understand text business for a while, just way before all of this new fancy stuff came around with ChatGPT. The way that I use AI, I use it as a service, as an API, to do things like contract analysis. So I have software that you can email a PDF to and it'll summarize the PDF, for example. Or you can ask it a question about a document and it'll give you an answer. If you have like a 200-page deep contract, you know, and you have to get a specific answer out of that, it's kind of annoying to do that. If you want to summarize a lot of them and maybe make a business decision, then that's really hard to do. People don't want to do that type of job. I like to use AI for the things that people don't want to do so they can do the things that they want to do and make themselves more efficient. So that's how I see artificial intelligence. It's just a tool in the toolbox that I can use for things that I couldn't do 5 years ago, which is amazing.
You build things called agents.
Right.
What is an agent?
So there, agents have a bunch of definitions, but I'll tell you, you know, there are a couple. I'll talk about two definitions of agents. So what I just described is, I'll call that just a workflow agent or a software integration agent, where AI is used in part of the software to do specific tasks, but then it fits in the natural software workflow, right? So if I have a bunch of documents sitting on my disk and I use an app or software where I take these through an approval process, for an example. And you know, that's a workflow. And then, well, maybe as part of the process, I have to pull out facts and figures. So AI is used in that step, right, to make that workflow a little bit you know, give it less friction, make things a little bit more efficient. So that's so an agent, you ask it to do things and it draws upon an existing set of capabilities. Well, it'll go off and do things based on your request. But again, in an existing scope of what the software does. So like, you know, maybe contract workflow software, and it can do different things. And maybe it can, you know, put a date on a calendar, or, you know, send an email, or, you know, send something out for signature, or come up with a summary, right? So that's a set of defined things. So an agent is just there to do tasks for you, maybe like an artificial intern, for example. You can think of it like that. Now, there are other types of agents, and this is what a lot of people, there's a lot of hype around this, which I will call native AI. And native AI is another type of agent where the scope is not bounded, and you can ask it to do a task that is not part of the current software that you're using, right? And the way it accomplishes that is it will go off and it will write more code to accomplish the task, or create new pathways in the code, or new parts of the stack to accomplish what it needs to do. So there's a lot of excitement about these new native AI agents, native agents. And there's a big problem with them right now, because if you use artificial intelligence to generate code, if you're an engineer and you're listening to this right now, you'll know that it makes mistakes, right? And as all software engineers do, because typically of lack of definition and lack of knowledge. So it'll make an assumption, it'll make a mistake, and it won't fit. So you have this problem where you have this law of compounding errors, where if it needs to generate a lot of different methods to do one task, some of the methods might be wrong. And the more things you generate, the more things you create to use, the more mistakes it has. And it just compounds and it gets worse and worse and worse until eventually the whole thing might just fall apart. Your system is just full of bugs and it's useless. So those are agents. Those are two different things, where you have one that's scoped and it's well-defined and you're using it for a very specific task and you can evaluate it very well. And then you have this unbounded scope where it can just create its own thing and it's hard to evaluate and it's probably going to mess up.
Okay. So part of what you're building. It's part of how you're using AI as a chief brainiac of Max.io. For the public who uses GPT for fun, sometimes for various tasks, what would be different about O3 that's coming that's going to be better for the public?
That's a great question. So we gave a little bit of a definition of what AI is, where you train a model and it does a task, right? So O3 is just another generation on top of ChatGPT. And the way GPT works is it's a certain type of model. I'm not going to go into all the details because we don't have time to do that. But basically, you give it a prompt and it'll just predict the output to the prompt. A prompt is just what you type in as the person, what you want the model to do, and it'll give you a response. So if I give you a prompt, and I can say, okay, what do I got to do to solve this mathematical problem, right? Now, maybe it'll just spit out an answer. GPT will just give you an answer, and it's probably wrong, right? If it's a complex mathematical problem.
GPT is not good at complex math?
No, it's not. It's not good at a lot of complex things, right? It's good at well-known, well-defined things.
Okay.
But so that's the GPT 3.5, GPT 4, these types of models. Now, there's a technique called chain of thought prompting, which is an interesting technique that some researchers discovered a couple years ago, where instead of just telling it what you want and it trying to spit out an answer immediately, you say, before you answer, think about this thing step by step and write down all the steps. So that's called chain of thought prompting. So you can give it a complex problem and it'll say, well, first I got to do this and then this and then this. So if I say, well, how do you build a house out of Lego? You know, you can say, well, first I'm going to build the foundation pieces, and then I'm going to build the walls pieces and make holes for the windows and the doors, and then I'm going to build the bedrooms inside, you know, and then I'll put it on a roof eventually. So I've spelled out all these steps. So that we find that technique works a lot better for complicated problems because it has to generate its own steps, and then it can go back and look at the steps that it's generated, and then it draws on that to create the final answer.
Right? Chain of thought.
Chain of thought prompting, yeah. So O1... and O3 are models that use that method as part of their training. So when the model is being trained, it uses that. It doesn't just produce the final answer. There's actually a step in the training that says, okay, there's a step generating process, and then it uses those steps. And then they implement things like backtracking, where it can try to find errors in the steps that it generated. It can reevaluate things. So I'm going to call this pseudo reasoning, because it's not actually reasoning. It's kind of faking it. It does a good job of laying out what all the steps are, and it might do a good job of, you know, saying, well, this might not look right, but it's not actually reasoning. It's just generation. You're just generating stuff and then generating based on what you've generated before. When we talk about reasoning in a complex sense, there's more to it than that. Now, what that actually is, it's hard to pin down. I don't think we really even know. But a lot of people think there's something missing. You know, the way that these models are trained, it's not a full picture. It's not all there. So it does a great job of faking it, and it does a really good job of doing things. But there's something else that's not quite right. It has a really hard time, especially with negatives. If you tell it not to do something, and a great example of this is like, okay, draw a picture of a room without a pink elephant. Like, do not put a pink elephant in the room when you draw this picture. It will make the room, and it might not have a pink elephant in it. And then you say, okay, well, pan the camera to see the other side. And it'll pan the camera and draw the other half of the room. And there's a pink elephant in the room because you've put it in there. It's like it's in the context. So it does a terrible job at these types of tasks. And it's really, really interesting.
This is GPT or O3?
I haven't tested this with O3, but that's a visual. That's like a DALL-E. That's DALL-E. That's like a model that generates images. So that's totally
different. Oh, okay. Yeah. Image generator. Okay.
Yeah. But these newer models are multimodal. Multimodal is it handles different.
You're
types
talking
of
about
data.
The models of AI that we currently have.
Yeah.
Really struggle with this kind of.
Yeah.
I'd like this idea. Do not put a pink elephant. And the AI is like, but you've told me about the pink elephant. Like, I have to. Obviously, pink elephants are contextually relevant to rooms.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, of course they aren't. So the model doesn't reason that out. Okay. Is O3 better with that? Are future models will get better at that, right?
They get better, but so that's the other interesting thing is, you know, is this idea of, like, hitting a wall. Are we hitting a wall with the capability? Because to train GPT-3, it costs $5 million to train that model. To train the O1 model, people speculate it cost $5 billion to train that model. And I don't know how much they spent on O3. O3 most likely being another iteration of O1. And now there's this talk of GPT-5. And I don't the names don't make any sense. I have trouble discerning what the next generation would be, GPT-5 compared to the O1. Flavor.
And now imagine how the public feels.
Yeah.
By the way,
even I can't figure out.
Couldn't they have asked GPT-4 for help naming the future models?
They should have just stuck with that convention. Four and a half, five, or
something that's not this weird goblet. Who is doing this? It's bad.
Yeah.
It's bad marketing. It's very confusing. Why am I getting upset at you, Max? Max, like, I didn't do it. Max, you agree with me.
I'm also terrible at naming things, so I didn't name their thing.
But now you have AI to ask. Have it help you. It's good at this stuff.
It is.
It's taking people's jobs. Okay. Anyway, we've covered a lot of ground there. I don't want to get too bogged down. O3 likely out sometime in 2025. Max's view, if you're just joining us, is this is not AGI. This is not artificial general intelligence. It is a very impressive step forward. But a future of AGI. Are we going to achieve AGI, by the way?
I don't know.
Are you somebody who thinks it's inevitable? You're not?
I don't think it's inevitable. I think it's inevitable that people are going to start. They're going to keep trying. And, you know, why we're trying is maybe a heart of existential question of humanity, of pioneering and going out in the new frontiers. I don't know why we keep trying to do these things. We want better models, but I don't know why AGI is the goal for these companies, honestly.
Elaborate a little bit. This is important.
Yeah. So I know what I get with better tools, right? I get an ability to solve problems better, right? And we want to solve problems to make lives easier.
You know why we made better hammers. You know why we made better screwdrivers.
I believe in better tools. I don't believe, what is the point of creating an entity that can think for itself and is intelligent? I mean, aside from just the, you know, Everest climbing, flag planting thing that we can say, we did it. We made AGI, which is, you know, but that's a very human quality, I think, to do that, the unexplored, you know, thing to do. Aside from that, I don't know what the why are all these companies saying we want to create AGI? Is it so that do they have these nefarious goals of like, well, we just want to replace all the workers because we're tired of hiring people and dealing with human resources? Is that I don't know. I can't give you an answer what the motivations are aside from this like humanistic. Like,
well, there's not
I
just
do it.
There's not just one motivation. There's multiple.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I think the Everest thing is a big part of it. It's if we can do it, we're doing it. You're not stopping us. Which I don't think is healthy, but I think it's human. I think it there's a capitalistic, if we can replace 3/4 of the workforce, we're doing it. But then there's also this curiosity, like, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Which, you know, let's stick this fork in the socket and see what happens. I don't know. I think the question of why, though, it needs to keep happening.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you bringing that up. I really do. With that in mind, can we get some of your predictions for 2025?
Sure.
All right. Max Irwin's got some predictions. We're looking ahead to 2025. Automated browsers. What's an automated browser?
Yeah, that's a good question. So these are actually kind of showing up now. So this isn't necessarily – this is the first like low-hanging fruit prediction that I'm making because we're starting to see these things. An automated browser – and again, names are terrible, but the Anthropic company calls their thing computer use capability. Well, what does that mean, computer use? Basically, an agent, we've already talked about agents.
Yep.
An automated browser is what I'd like to call it, is you give it a task and it has to go and browse the web and use apps and content on the internet in this long-term goal, right? So I want to book travel for my family, right? And then it goes and it finds the best places and might ask you some questions over email or text or through the app and then eventually get some answers. And then it goes and it'll find the cheapest thing that fits with whatever and it'll book it for you and then you're done. So you don't have to do the endless hunting yourself. You can go off and maybe take care of your kids in the background while this thing is happening. Right. So that's what an automated browser is. You give it a task and it uses the web browser just like you would to accomplish something that maybe is tedious and annoying.
Okay. And that's coming.
That's coming. It's going to be really expensive. I don't know if they're going to work out the pricing.
Okay. All right. As soon as 2025, that's coming, though.
Oh, yeah. You can download early versions of these now if you are part of the community, if you're plugged in. You can try to use these things.
Now, prediction number two is on the negative side. You think there will be a lot of abandoned initiatives.
Right. So that what I just said for the automated browsers rolls into this thing, which is the cost. This stuff costs a lot of money, and they need more and more computing power to handle these things. When you think about how AI works and what it takes, is it requires huge data centers and computation and memory and energy and water and all this stuff to power these things. And if I'm just giving it a couple words, it'll generate a prompt. It'll do that pretty quickly. That costs like, you know, fractions of a penny. It costs almost nothing, right? But when you are taking a full screen sharing video of everything that's going on in a browser and it's taking feedback and it's seeing where the mouse cursor is, doing this over and over and over, it's super expensive to do that. And when you have a lot of tasks that look at huge documents and take in a lot of information and they're slow, these things get expensive. So the abandoned initiatives is, well, yeah, we can get this thing to work and it works okay and it does a pretty good job of it. But the amount of money that we're spending to get this to work, we don't see the value return as a business. So we're going to say, hey, that was fun, but we've sunk a lot of cost into this and we're not getting the value return. So we're going to chuck it out the door.
2025, you think, will be a year where we start to streamline a little and say, this project doesn't make sense, too expensive. We don't need AI here. We're gonna get smarter. And some of the reason it gets expensive is, which leads to your next point, there's a ton of energy involved. And you think there will be an intense debate about energy.
Yes, absolutely. We're already seeing this now. Meta and Google and OpenAI all came out and said that they want their own nuclear reactors to power their data centers. Spinning up a nuclear reactor or, you know, repurposing one like Three Mile Island, which is something that's, I think Meta is after Three Mile Island, to spin that up again, to power a data center, just seems completely misaligned with our current problems and goals right now in humanity. When you think about how clean energy is so important to things like heating homes, you know, powering vehicles, producing food, it's just a huge problem. So to say, well, we're going to take this nuclear reactor and repurpose it or create a new one, but instead of being able to, you know, solve the problem of growing food and providing energy to grow food, we're instead going to make it so your web browser works automatically. Right? So that's not aligned with, I think, what our goals should be for energy expansion. Right?
I mean, you're a big fan of crypto. And so the Greenwich plant down in Seneca Lake just got, they've won a recent battle to keep using the energy production there to try to mine for Bitcoin. You think that's a good use of energy?
No, I don't. And, that's how we first met, is I came on to talk about how I didn't like, you know, the energy use of crypto and what's the point of all this stuff. And this is conflicting for me, because I was saying these things and then GPT happened. You know, we had those discussions, I think maybe right after GPT came out.
Yeah.
I wasn't fully aware of the energy implications, but now AI is using more energy than crypto. So that's a big conflict for me personally, to know that, well, I know that these tools are good and I want these tools to work, but is it worth it? So that's kind of a question that I ask myself a lot.
And you think there's going to be some intense debate about that?
Absolutely.
In 2025?
Yeah.
Probably needs to happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You think regulatory initiatives are coming? What kind?
So we've already seen a lot of regulatory stuff in the EU. A lot of people are kind of maybe a little bit upset or confused because they can't use tools like GPT in the EU with European data, because there are now regulations that you can't use it for certain things. So I think we're not going to see anything that extreme in the United States, but
not with Elon Musk in the White House.
Yeah, who knows what's going to happen with the next administration? I don't want to, you know, it's hard to make predictions there,
because
anything's on the table. But, you know, there's still, there are things like, there are certain people's names that you can't type into GPT. It'll say, sorry, we can't return this request for you, because they've sued OpenAI successfully and said, well, your model said bad things about me. So they put in a block. So I think we're going to see some things related to people's private data, and some more regulations, understanding around privacy and using private data to train models. I think we might see something along those lines.
All right, moving quickly here. At least you got on the list, AI military escalation. What do you think could happen?
That's already happening now in the, you know, Russian invasion of Ukraine. You know, we're seeing AI-powered drones to seek out targets and, you know, do things. So I just think that there's a lot of things happening in the space, and I'm not a fan. I don't think anybody should be. The problem is that it's kind of like this analogy, the boiling frog problem.
Oh yeah.
So it's just, well, okay, we see that maybe Ukraine hooks up something to a drone to, you know, maybe save their own country and their people, and then we're like, okay, you did that. You saved yourself. Great. But now this tech is out there and it's just kind of happening, and nobody really, that's the thing that I don't like about the whole Terminator Skynet thing, is like, it just kind of happened overnight. It's not going to be the kind of happened overnight. It's going to be this long, gradual road to things getting worse and worse and worse over time, these little incidents. And eventually, before you know it, we're in this horrible, horrible scenario.
Right. And then a smart conversation about drones would not look like the one in New Jersey, which is a mass psychosis event. But what it opens up is, are we talking enough about how protected we are and what it means to regulate and know what the airspace looks like? So, but we're not having that smart conversation. We're having 90 seconds. So the last two here. You think there's going to be some IP copyright case decisions coming?
Yeah, so the New York Times versus OpenAI, I think we're going to see a resolution there. I don't know which way it'll go, but I think we're going to see something that's going to decide, well, can AI companies just sweep up data and use it to train their models? So we're going to see some court decisions.
And the New York Times has been resisting that.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a big lawsuit. that's ongoing.
Okay. And whenever that comes down, we're going to need to really digest it and understand it, because that's an important one, I think.
Absolutely.
And then a plateau of productivity. Why a plateau?
So, in the hype cycle, the last stage is the plateau of productivity. Go look up the hype cycle if you don't know what it is. But that's the last step where you find kind of a balance of how these tools are used and what they're useful for, and are they doing their job? They're not overhyped expectations. They're not horrible things, but they're useful, and you can find use in them.
And that would actually be a healthy development, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay. See, there, you're closing with a little optimism. closing with a little pessimism, Patrick writes to say, the Boston Dynamics' latest robot has swivel hips. It's really cool. They abandoned their old hydraulic version. Swivel hips could come for us. Yeah, we used to make fun of those Boston Dynamics robots, and now those things are horrifying. I think Patrick's totally right. That's probably what's going to do us then, is those guys. I want to thank you for helping us understand not only O3, which is the newest model from OpenAI that's coming likely in 2025, but helping kind of keep our head on straight as best we can about AI. I appreciate it and look forward to more conversation in 2025.
Thanks, Evan. It's been wonderful.
And if people want to find you and talk to you more outside of Connections World, where do they find you, Max?
You can just email me at max@max.io.
Max Irwin, founder of Max.io, Flower City AI, and a frequent guest here. We're grateful for that. And thank you for listening on this Monday afternoon. A lot to come this week from your public radio. And whatever form we find you in, have a wonderful week. We'll talk to you later on member-supported public media.